Hi, I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold. If you are unfamiliar with my other podcast, I often cover stories from the television show Unsolved Mysteries. For the past 5 years, you've heard me talk about these cases on my own, but now's your chance to hear me have in-depth discussions about them with other people. I want to welcome you to my new project, The Path Went Chilly, where I will be discussing in-depth with my two good friends and co-hosts cases that I've covered on The Trail Went Cold. Meet my co-hosts. First one up is Jules.
Hi, I'm Jules from the podcast Riddle Me That True Crime, and I have a PhD in transpersonal counseling. I'm not a psychologist or a diagnostician, so don't get too excited, but I can't wait to analyze these cases with these two amazing humans. You've already met Robin, now meet Dr. Ashley Wellman.
Hi, I'm Ashley. I have a PhD in criminology, law, and society, and I specialize in trauma victims and survivors. I've spent a great deal of time working with families left behind after homicides with a cold case unit based out of Florida, and I'm also a professor of criminology. I'm so excited to be chatting with two of my best friends about the cases that everyone can't seem to get enough of.
We hope in doing so that we will have a clearer perspective of what may have transpired. Oftentimes, Ashley will be totally in the dark.
Jules and I will be telling Ashley a story she may not know much about, so all of her reactions are genuine.
We will be releasing on all major platforms April 8th.
We hope you will join us as we attempt to heat up some ice-cold cases.
The Path Went Chilly will be available every Thursday on all major podcast platforms.
True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I'm your host, Eric Carter Bondine.
The story of Sarah Beard was once the most well-known unsolved crime in New Mexico. Everyone knew her story. It was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in 1994, but since then, the episode was taken down, and the story has been lost to time. Sarah's story is tangled, and there's a lot that goes into it. It's still an open case, and it's worth remembering the events of December 8, 1988. Sarah Beard was a student at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. She was studying sociology and had elective classes in art. She had a close circle of friends, and she had embraced the Rastafarian culture and spirituality. Her circle revolved around that belief. She was very close to her parents, despite having a small apartment in Nob Hill. She often spent the night at her parents' home, and they would drive her to school off and on. On the night of December 6th, she'd spent the night with her parents. The next morning, she made her parents breakfast and said she wanted to go back to her apartment to take a bath. So her father gave her a ride home. It was cold and windy in Albuquerque that day. The sky was gray, but there wasn't any snow in the forecast. On the afternoon of December 7th, Sarah was getting ready to go to class when a man stopped by her apartment to borrow some paints for an art project. Sarah didn't know the man well. He was a friend of her boyfriend. He was known to be homeless, often hanging around campus, asking students for money, and Sarah felt sorry for him. She would let him borrow things or would give him money on occasion. Sarah even let him stay at her apartment one night when her boyfriend was there. It was cold outside, and she didn't want him to freeze to death. She gave him some blankets and let him sleep on her couch. The next morning, he was gone. She was angry with him because he had taken the blankets and some money with him. She only knew him as Wadada. On this day, Sarah let Wadada into her apartment, told him where the paints were, and started to put her shoes on so she could go to class. She also confronted him about the money and the blankets he had taken from her. She asked that at least the blankets be returned. Wadada became angry. He approached Sarah from behind and held a knife to her throat. He forced her into a closet where he told her to take her clothes off. Sarah put up a struggle, but in the end, did as she was told. When she had her clothes off, Wadada said he didn't want her anymore. He told her to put her clothes back on. Relieved, Sarah did as she was told and started to leave the closet. Then he changed his mind again and told her to undress. Sarah once again did as she was told, but was upset to think that she had almost escaped from this man. She began to cry. As Wadada was raping Sarah, he forced her to chant a Rastafarian prayer over and over. She knew the prayer. He had recited it several times for her. He also asked her several times if she was sleeping with anyone else. She told him that she wasn't. Later, she would tell police that she had the feeling that he was raping her for someone else. When he finished, Sarah sat up on the edge of the bed, hoping that he would just leave. She couldn't look at him. Again, Wadada slipped up behind her. This time, he had a hammer. Wadada hit her in the head with a hammer several times, and then he raped her again. He stole more money from her and left. He cut the phone line and locked the door on his way out. He left Sarah to die there. Sarah's wounds were extensive. She was in and out of consciousness. She was helpless. She tried banging on the floor and the walls for help, but she wasn't strong enough to make much noise. A neighbor would later tell investigators that he heard someone banging on metal in her apartment, but it didn't last very long. So he thought she was working on a project. Sarah was supposed to call her mother at 7 o'clock that morning, but that call never came. Sarah had plans to go Christmas shopping with her mom, Susan. Susan came by the apartment to check on Sarah at around 10:30 a.m. But when she knocked, nobody answered. She left a note on the door for Sarah. Susan tried calling Sarah several times, but Sarah never picked up. Susan didn't think that was unusual either. Sometimes Sarah would turn the ringer off if she wanted to take a nap or was studying. Susan waited to hear from her daughter. On the 8th, when there was still no word from Sarah, Susan went by the apartment again. This time, she noticed that all of Sarah's blinds were closed. That was unusual for Sarah. She never closed her blinds. When Susan got to the apartment, she saw that the note that she left the previous day was still there. Susan was worried about her daughter before, but now she began to panic. She went to the property manager's office and got a key and let herself into Sarah's apartment. The first thing Susan noticed was that there was blood on the floor coming from the bathroom. Then she heard Sarah moaning and trying to cry out for help. When she went into Sarah's bedroom, she saw her, semi-conscious and bleeding on the floor between her bed and the wall. Susan picked up the phone in Sarah's apartment to call 911, but realized that the phone lines were cut. She eventually found a phone and was able to connect with 911. As this was before cell phones, she had to go in search of another phone to borrow. When police and rescue arrived, Sarah's apartment became a crime scene. First responders stabilized Sarah as best they could and rushed her to Presbyterian Hospital in Albuquerque, where Sarah underwent emergency surgery for a traumatic brain injury. She was not expected to live. Doctors believe that if she did live, she may not be able to function. Sarah did eventually make a full recovery, but it took months and months of rehabilitation. Crime scene investigators found several pieces of evidence in the apartment. They found a notebook with drawings in it. The drawings had taglines on them, and they said things like Zionist, filth, and Wadada. There was a bracelet on the bed that did not belong to Sarah. It was a metal Rastafarian bracelet. They also found the claw hammer that was used to attack her. Investigators noticed that Sarah was dressed, but the way she was dressed looked like somebody else might have dressed her after the attack. They found a towel covered in blood. It appeared that someone had either tried to clean up the blood or had tried to help Sarah. When Sarah arrived at the hospital, investigators were there to meet her. They took fingernail clippings, collected Sarah's hair after her head had been shaved for surgery, and they did a sexual assault forensic exam. During the exam, they collected evidence from Sarah's body. Sarah's mother was interviewed at the hospital. She told investigators about a phone call that Sarah had received a few nights before. The caller wanted Sarah to come out to the parking lot and talk with him. Susan told investigators that Sarah had recognized the voice as someone she knew, but she couldn't put the voice with a name. Susan also told investigators that Sarah had refused to meet the man in the parking lot. She had a friend staying over that night, and the girls locked the doors and windows and went to sleep. When Sarah was able to speak with investigators, she told them that the man on the phone was Wadada. Susan also told investigators about Sarah's boyfriend. His name was Wendell Davis. He was known by the nickname Dillinger. Davis had moved from Miami, Florida to Albuquerque with his mother to get away from the Rastafarian drug culture in Miami. He had been in trouble in Florida and was hoping to turn his life around in New Mexico. Rastafari is a religious-based culture that began in Jamaica in the 1930s. It's an Afro-Caribbean religion that bases belief in the Bible. They base their homeland or Holy Land in Africa. Rastafarians could be considered an ethnic group since they have their own shared heritage, their own religion, and their own language. They have one god who is referred to as Jah, and he lives within each individual. They follow rules of living naturally, wearing their hair in dreads, adhering to patriarchal gender roles, and following a strict diet known as Ital.
See, because Wadada did go up to Santa Fe several times. He made some friends with people up there. I mean, he came on as a cool dreadlock, you know, with high values and stuff, and verbally, you know. But
what he did was not consistent?
No.
What is dreadlock? I thought dreadlock was a hairstyle, to show you how stupid.
Well, it is a hairstyle, but dreads really have to do with not an injunction, but a set of rules, sort of, for people who, it's in Numbers chapter 6 in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
If you separate yourself to God, there are these things you have to do. And one of them is you have to let your hair grow. Let the locks of the head of your hair grow.
Uh-huh.
And so you let your hair grow naturally, without combing it, without cutting it, without doing anything to it. And so for Rastafari, it's a spiritual thing. But there are people who, anybody can let their hair grow like this.
Sure, sure.
So there are people who use it, you know,
okay,
in
so,
wrong ways. Or they just wear dreadlocks to be cool or,
so
you know, to...
So where you're concerned and your friends that are dreads are also Rastafarian?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
See, and Rastas aren't really gangsters and criminals and killers, but there's many people who have assumed that look who are that,
right.
You know, in order to...
Cause everybody...
Right, yeah. Right.
And we all have... Everybody, every group has that problem.
Yeah,
you know, the group
yeah
itself
sort of like
be,
infiltrators or something, or
right.
Outfiltrators even.
Or even that, or, you know, that, you know, all it takes is a couple of people...
Messing things up,
right?
Yeah.
To,
for everybody.
To put a bad line on everybody, that's
right.
Exactly right. Karen, can you think of anyone that might have a picture of this guy?
No, I don't think anybody ever.
You said he spoke Ethiopian, is that what you said?
Yeah, he used some Amharic words, and probably he could have learned them anywhere, you know.
Okay,
I mean,
so it wasn't like he was fluent.
I don't think he was fluent. I feel that Roots thought he might have been fluent,
okay.
and Roots knew some Amharic too, but it's not an easy language to learn, and I think it was just like he was impressed that this guy knew some Amharic, you know, because Rastas relate to Ethiopia directly in terms of Haile Selassie. So learning that language or learning even a couple of words in it is like a valuable thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Investigators found that Davis was out of town when the assault on Sarah occurred. He had gone to Alabama to visit family. A few days after the assault, Sarah regained consciousness, but she couldn't speak. Her father, Jim, devised a method of communication with Sarah. She was to squeeze his hand for yes and do nothing if the answer to a question was no. Using this method, Jim began to recite the alphabet for Sarah. He told her to squeeze his hand when he came to the letter that would identify her attacker. Jim slowly went through the alphabet. He began to lose hope as he neared the end of the alphabet with no response from Sarah. He thought his method had been a fluke. Then, he reached the letter W. And Sarah squeezed his hand. Jim asked if the name of her attacker was Wadada, and she squeezed his hand again. They had a name. Jim and Susan went to the police with this information, but investigators told them that unless Sarah could verbalize her attacker's name, the information would not be taken into consideration. Sarah continued to heal, and as she healed, she began to speak. She told investigators that her attacker was Wadada. She also helped them draw a sketch of him, and she told them that he had a deformed hand. His right hand was bent so that his fingers formed a fist, and it was covered in scars. She thought they were burn scars. She also told police that Wadada wasn't from the U.S. She thought he was from Africa, but could speak English and Spanish fluently. A sketch artist was brought in, and Sarah worked with the artist on a composite sketch of Wadada. She described him as a Rastafarian with his hair and dreadlocks. He was 5'9 to 6 foot tall, and had a medium build. Sarah didn't believe that he was really a Rastafarian. She said he didn't have the same values as Rastafarians usually have.
And Israel and Lion also knew Wadada, but
right.
They were leery of him.
They were leery of him, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they really hung too much with him because Israel especially didn't really, his first impression was very negative of it. And it didn't stem from anything Wadada said or did,
just
that first incident, you know? It was a coin.
It was an
Ethiopian coin with His Majesty, like this one, you know? I think he was trying to give Israel a coin
okay.
like that. It's just, you know, as a token of one Rasta to another, but Israel did not accept that coin. And it was right after, that was, I think, maybe the first time Israel had met him, too. And he was, trust that guy, trust that guy, trust that guy.
Huh. And Israel and Lyons said no, they wouldn't take the coin.
Right.
Police continued their investigation. Now they had information that could help them ID the man who had so brutally assaulted Sarah. How hard could it be to find a Rastafarian with a deformed hand? Investigators questioned Sarah again and again, but she could give no further information. By January of 1989, it seemed that the case had begun to grow cold. Sarah would be in recovery for months, and some of her answers were confused. At one point, she thought Wadada had beat her with a spoon. Then she thought it was a knife. She never remembered much about the attack or any time immediately after the attack. She told police that her mother had told her that he had beat her with a hammer. She remembered specifics about the rape, though. She remembered the chant and the way he asked if she was involved with another man. She also remembered that he raped her several times before he beat her. They had a rough composite sketch of Wadada and a composite sketch of the deformity to his hand, but that was it.
I don't know what else I can tell you. There were weird things that he did, though, that I remember. Like, his hand was paralyzed, or it seemed like it was paralyzed. He always held it in this position.
Right.
And
do you remember any scars on it?
You know, I don't remember seeing any scars on it, but he often asked us to put out cigarettes in his hand or just pass one in his hand like that, you know. He did weird things with his hand. Sometimes he would even make his hand stretch out more. You know, it looked like his fingers were stretching out. So I don't know if he really could move that hand or not. When he played drums with it, though, he kept it, his fingers were curled, you know, and the other hand played flat.
Okay.
So I don't really know whether that hand was as paralyzed as he wanted everybody to believe it was or not.
Well, when he did that, do you remember any scars or anything in the palm of his hand?
Now I can't recall whether there were or not.
Okay.
But there definitely might have been, because he was weird about having people burn things in his hand, you know. And he had kind of a... I guess he wanted to show you that it was totally... that it didn't have any feeling in it or something, you know.
Okay.
I don't know whether it really did or not, though, because I remember a couple of occasions where it looked like his fingers were stretching, like he could have some movement in his hand.
Uh-huh.
You know, it wasn't totally paralyzed. And I don't know. He never told us where he got that, or whether that was some...
He never said
from how his hand got that way. No, he never.
Do you remember which hand it is?
It was his right hand.
You're sure about that?
Yeah, so I'm doing this like it. Uh-huh. It was weird. If you'd offer him food or something, he would always use that hand. You know, it was like he was trying to get sympathy in some kind of weird way from using that hand as a receiving hand, you know, when it really couldn't. It couldn't grasp, he gave you the impression it couldn't grasp anything. You know?
Yeah, and you never saw him use it like a normal hand?
No, I never did, except when he was playing drums and his fingers were still curled.
Yeah.
Then investigators got a tip. A homeless man named Sam Johnson was brought in for questioning. He met all the criteria of Wadada, including the deformed hand. They arrested Sam Johnson, but instead of putting him in a cell, they took him to a local park. Police asked Sarah to come to the park to ID the man, but she sent her boyfriend Wendell Davis instead. David told police that Sam Johnson was not Wadada. The police let him go. Investigators infiltrated the homeless community in Albuquerque and found some of Wadada's associates. They all said they hadn't seen him since early December. Police interviewed a man named Milton. He was also a part of the Rasta culture. He hung around with Wadada and was friends with Dillinger and Sarah. He said that Sarah was a witch, and he said that Wadada believed that Sarah was a witch also.
Actually, because there was that thing where he was saying I was a witch.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, I have no idea where he came up with that exactly, but, I probably did tell you about this, or I told the police about this or something, but there's this homeless guy that I knew and that Wadada knew, just one of these people that hanged around the UNM area, and he's always coming by my house, like, trying to get me to give him pot smoke, and I never, usually wouldn't, you know, but one time he came by and I let him have the contents of my ashtray, which is, like, really rude, but anyway, that's what I did, and he took it and everything, and he found, like, the little pieces of, you know, maybe like a little piece of hair and wax and matchsticks in there and stuff. And he like decided that I was trying to kill him. And
this is Wagata?
No, this was the homeless guy. Yeah. And he's like super paranoid. Yeah. He's way out there. But at any rate, you know, so he was like convinced I was a witch. And so, and I've heard at least that that he told Wagata that I was a witch. And that then that was like, you know, maybe a day or two before Wagata attacked me. But
that's what was this guy's name?
The homeless guy? Milton.
Another man named Richard Halpern, whose nickname was Root, told police that Wagata had a girlfriend in Santa Fe and would go there to visit her when he wasn't in Albuquerque. He told police that the girlfriend's name was Elisa Lucero. When police tried to catch up with her, they had found that she had moved and left no forwarding address. Richard also relayed some disturbing information about Wagata. He told police that Wagata hated whites, particularly white women. Wagata blamed whites for ruining his life. Sarah was white. Investigators did find out that a man matching Wadada's description had visited Lucero's address before she moved, but the neighbor who reported this said that he hadn't seen the man since. Police had also found that Wagata had made a long-distance phone call from Wendell's phone to Dunlop Tire in Grand Island, New York. When police tried to track down the call, they found that the phone call went to a shipping and receiving desk. No one recalled getting a call from Albuquerque on that phone, and no one recognized the name Wagata. This led investigators to obtain a subpoena for Sarah's phone records as well. They found that Wagata had made several calls from Sarah's phone. One of the calls was to a residence in Bountiful, Utah. And that is where they caught up with Lisa Lucero. She said that she knew Wagata. She also told investigators that he had a visa from Liberia and that his father was English. She said that she had met him in Santa Fe, but hadn't seen him since before Christmas. She then told officers that she wouldn't say any more and did not want to be involved. On February 10th, 1989, Crime Stoppers featured Sarah's case as their crime of the week. They immediately got a hit. Someone who worked with job services called in a tip that a man named Doyen Gambuzu came in looking for work. The tipster said they remembered seeing his work visa and that he was from Africa. They also remembered that he had a disability, but couldn't remember what the disability was. Investigators now had a name, and they worked frantically to track down Doyen Gambuzu. They contacted the Department of Immigration and Naturalization and obtained all records for Doyen Gambuzu. Gambuzu's criminal history was clear. He had no criminal history in Liberia and not so much as a traffic ticket since he arrived in the U.S. Investigators found that odd, but they were convinced that Gambuzu was their man. Through the records that they obtained, they found that he was married to a woman in Nashville. They contacted his wife, and she told investigators that she hadn't seen or heard from Gambuzu since 1985. She didn't know any of his relatives or any of his friends. He simply vanished. They asked her if Gambuzu was violent in any way. She said that he wasn't. She told them that he traveled around the country looking for work. When asked about his disability, his wife said that she had never known him to have any kind of disability. She did, however, have an old picture of him, which she sent to the police in Albuquerque. Police showed the picture to Wendell Davis, Sarah's boyfriend. Davis said the picture didn't look anything like Wagata. When they showed the picture to Sarah, she said she couldn't be sure whether it was him or not. The picture was 5 years old, and Wagata had changed a lot. The police issued a John Doe warrant for the arrest of Wagata, aka Doyen Gambuzu. Bond was set for $100,000 cash only. There was a grand jury hearing, and Doyen Gambuzu was indicted for criminal sexual assault, attempted murder, assault, and kidnapping. Doyen Gambuzu was arrested in 1993 in South Carolina and was immediately transported to Albuquerque. After several months in custody, Sarah was brought in to identify Gambuzu as her attacker, but she said that that was not Wagata. Gambuzu did not look anything like Wagata, and he didn't have the same handicap that Wagata had. In fact, Gambuzu didn't have any disability at all. He had been working in Jacksonville, Florida from 1988 to 1999 for Electrode Steel. As a day laborer, he was building a school in Jacksonville. He gave the name and phone number of the dispatcher at the company, and his story checked out. He could not have possibly been in Albuquerque at that time. He also told the story of a man he encountered earlier in 1988 while working at a temporary labor camp in Jacksonville. He said the man called himself Medicine Man and that he performed voodoo. This man had a temper and was very easily angered. Doyen said the man never worked but mostly hung around the camp, asking for money from the laborers. He had scars on one of his hands, and that hand was deformed. It was bent forward, forming a fist. Doyen said that this man couldn't use that hand. He also told police that he was walking with a cane. Doyen told investigators that, quote, Medicine Man was from the West Indies somewhere. He didn't know where. He said that people feared Medicine Man because of his temper, his looks, and his reputation for working voodoo. Doyen said that he only knew Medicine Man for a couple of months and that he lived in the same rooming house as Doyen. Doyen said that after Medicine Man left the rooming house, there was a burglary. His room was burgled and several items belonging to him were stolen. These items included his passport, his green card, his birth certificate, and his social security card. Doyen described Medicine Man as being a black man, 5'7 to 5'9, about 150 to 160 pounds, medium build, and his hair in dreadlocks. When Doyen was shown the composite drawing of Wadada, he identified the person in the composite as Medicine Man. A John Doe warrant was issued on January 7, 1989, Gambuzo's name was added on March 10th, and the case was closed pending arrest. This means that the case wasn't worked for 4 years. The police had gotten tunnel vision and only looked for Gambuzo. And by the time Gambuzo was exonerated, the case had grown very cold. Without a name, without anything else, there was very little hope of finding the man known as Wadada. We're going to take a quick break. And we're back. In 1993, several of Wadada's associates were interviewed again. They were asked to make new composite sketches, and they were asked about his whereabouts.
This is Inspector Greg Karzewski of the Alameda County District Attorney's Office in Oakland, California. Present is Inspector Cindy Hall and Lisa Lucero. The time is 2:40 p.m. on the 17th of August, 1993. Lisa, for the purposes of the tape, would you please spell your name and give your date of birth?
L-I-S-A, Lucero, L-U-C-E-R-O.
And the location we're at is 3909 Elston Avenue in Oakland. Okay, Lisa, we've been through some questions already, some questions and answers that you've provided us. And what I'd like to do is just ask you a series of questions that the Mexico authorities asked us to ask you. And the first one is, when and where did you meet the person you know as Wadada?
In summer of 88, I think in Santa Fe on Plaza, in the Plaza in Santa Fe.
Okay, and I think you told us that you met him through a community art gallery there?
Yeah. An art gallery, right.
And did somebody introduce you to him?
No.
You just kind of met. Okay. When was the last time you heard from him or saw him? Which was first? Did you see him?
The last time I saw him was probably in September.
Of 88,
and the last time I heard from him, I guess it was November 88.
During that phone call that he made to your parents' house in Utah?
Right.
Okay. And as far as that phone call goes, you don't remember too much about what was said during that conversation?
No, I don't remember.
Do you have any idea where he might be right now?
I talked about going to Mexico, and I think he had a friend in Florida. I think that was who he had a friend in Florida.
Is there any way that you would know of today how to contact him, or somebody that could contact him that you know?
There's just one family that I knew that he was friends with in Albuquerque. And I just know where they live, but I don't remember what their names are. Kind of remember where they live. They might know something, but
what part of
the people that I think that might know.
What part of Albuquerque are we talking about? I mean, is there...
Kind of towards the university in the office, central, before getting to the university, probably between Silver and Central, before getting to the university, if you're coming from downtown.
Okay. But you don't remember the exact street they lived on? Was it just like a house, a residence?
Yes.
And what did these people do? I mean, did the man work, or is it a couple we're talking about?
It was, I think, a man and a woman and two or three, maybe two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the man was a white man, Rastafarian white man, and the woman was a Mexican woman.
Okay. I don't know what. What do you mean a white Rastafarian? I'm not sure.
He had dreadlocks and he practiced Rastafarian religion.
And that's what also Wadada did?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they seem to be real. They were real spirit Rastafarians, not just a fad. Mm-hmm. They were real by the way they ate and the way they lived and everything. They're Rastafarians and what they believed in.
Is there a Rastafarian community in Albuquerque? Or is it just kind of a loose-knit organization there?
I would say it's kind of loose-knit, but I probably would say that most of the Rastafarians that there would know all the other Rastafarians.
Mm-hmm. Did this man work? Do you know if he had a job?
I'm sure he did, but I don't know what he did.
Now, you mentioned that you saw a piece of identification that Wadada had at one time. It was a passport.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember the name of the country that was on the passport was?
Algeria.
But you don't remember what the name was that was on it.
Yeah.
Did he ever refer to himself in your presence that you heard by any other name but Wadada?
No.
That was the only name you knew him by. Did he talk about having friends other than this maybe a friend in Miami, anywhere else in the United States?
No.
Did he ever say how long he'd been in this country?
No.
No. Now you mentioned at one time you thought you had a photograph of him. But you looked for it while we were here and you couldn't find it. If the possibility exists that you do come across that photo, will you give us a call?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know anybody else who might have a photograph of him?
No.
Okay, just for the record, would you start, say, from head to toe and give his physical description the way you remember him? His height, weight, and facial hair or lack of or hairstyle, anything like that. He's a black man, right?
Yes, black.
Is he real dark black?
He's like coffee color black. Not real black. Not black. It's kind of like coffee, I guess.
Okay.
He's about 6 foot. He was thin. And he had real thick dreadlocks, like maybe 3 inches thick. And he had kind of like a long face, kind of shallow, kind of the cheeks, I think. And,
Was there any scars on his face or marks? Any identifiable marks?
Not that I can remember.
Nothing. Okay, what about his hands? You mentioned something about one of his hands.
Yeah, one of his hands was more like, it was kind of clenched.
Like a closed fist, almost?
Mm-hmm. Almost.
You couldn't straighten the fingers up?
No.
And what hand do you believe that was?
I think it was the left.
Okay. Did he ever mention anything about this case the last time you talked to him?
No.
And you don't know anybody by the name of Sarah Beard? Did he ever tell you that he had been arrested anywhere before?
No.
You think he would have remembered something like that? Did you ever get much into his personal life at all in the times that you saw him and talked to him?
No, I don't think so. Did
he ever talk about like his family or his country?
He might have talked about his family, but I don't remember much.
So, as far as you know, that the last time you talked to him would have been that phone conversation.
Yeah.
That the authorities mentioned was, I think, the 12th of November of 1988. And you believe at that time he said he might be going to Miami or Mexico.
Yeah, he talked about going to Mexico, and I think he had a friend in Miami or Florida, I don't know.
Had he ever talked about going to Mexico before, when you knew him?
Yeah.
Any particular reason why he would want to go to Mexico? Mm. Never said?
Just because he wanted to travel, I guess. I don't know. Something like that. He's maybe been there before. Yeah. He spoke Spanish.
Well, he did speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Max, Strongly,
yeah.
When you saw his passport, did you see any date stamp or you said you saw him here? Did you ever see a date stamp?
No, I don't remember seeing him here.
The picture looked like him that you saw.
I think I remember seeing him, the picture looked like him, yeah.
Did he have dreadlocks in the picture?
Yeah.
The photograph that you had of him, was it like a photograph you took of him by himself? Or
no,
was
he
it
just gave me a picture of himself.
Oh, a picture of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And did that picture look like the way he looked?
Yeah, it was him.
I mean, the dreadlocks and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay, if there's anything else you could think of, I'm going to leave my card with you. Would you please, give me a call at any time?
Sure.
We'll see what you do. We'll end the interview at about 2:52 p.m. in the afternoon.
In Lisa's interview from 1993, she said that she saw Wadada's passport and the picture looked like him with dreads and everything. But if we listen to Karen Miller's version of the story, she said that she saw Wadada's passport and there was no picture. Interesting fact about the 80s and early 90s, pictures were glued onto passports, so it's quite possible that Wadada had taken Doyen's picture out of the passport and replaced it with his own.
And he had an accent.
Yeah, he had an accent. And I never really thought too much about where he was from. I guess if I had paid more attention, I don't know. But I never thought very much about where he was from until after this whole incident with Sarah. And then I started trying to think, well, where is he from and what is that accent? And it wasn't a Jamaican accent, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Although he might have claimed that he was even from Africa, so I don't know if it was an African accent, then I may be totally
is it possible,
in that field,
you know?
I guess it's possible. It seems to me that Roots said he had seen a passport that said that it was African, but the picture wasn't in the passport. So it could have been anybody's passport, you know?
Okay.
The only other distinguishing thing is his hand, his crippled hand.
In late 1993, Karen Miller was asked to do another composite of Wadada for Unsolved Mysteries. For the Unsolved Mysteries episode that aired in 1994, a second composite was done with Karen Miller, and this is the current composite of Wadada that law enforcement is using.
I know you've done this before, probably several times, but could you describe Wadada to me?
Okay. I think he is about 5'10", maybe an inch taller than that, but he's not that tall. Slender build. I would even say more than slender, you know, kind of skinny, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he had kind of a wide face at the temples, and then it came in very sharply at his from his jawbone to his chin was pretty sharp. And came to kind of a, not a really pointy chin, but, you know, the shape of his face was stark. His cheekbones were high and prominent. And his forehead was kind of high. His nose was very wide, flat. And lips were kind of like average width, I guess, for a black person. His eyes seemed deep, kind of deep set to me. You know, and that was because of his cheekbones being. Maybe his cheekbones just looked like they were real prominent because his face was thin, you know,
yeah.
He was kind of thin. And, let's see, how much would he have weighed? Maybe 50, maybe. I don't know if he would have weighed that much. He was pretty slender. He was very, like what I call wiry, you know, in build. Skin's fairly dark.
The John Doe warrant is in place even now, though the case has been committed to the archive, so it's not actively being worked. I would remind everyone that this case is still open, and if you have additional information about the attack on Sarah Beard or the location or identity of Wadada, please call the Albuquerque Police at 505-242-COPS. Sarah's case carries important lessons even today. I believe that much more could have been done to solve this case, and I think that it may be more solvable in 2021 than it was in 1988. Without a DNA sample on file, Wadada may never be caught. In the late 80s and early 90s, DNA was often not run because it was an expensive and time-consuming task. Because of this, DNA tests were only run when the case was prosecutable. In other words, if they already had the suspect in custody, DNA would be run. It didn't appear that DNA was ever run on Sarah's case at all. Many rape kits have been lost over the years. Some evidence in violent crimes gets destroyed after a certain period of time. Many times after the original investigator retires or has left the department, evidence will be destroyed. Sometimes, over the course of the investigation, evidence will be lost or misplaced. The chances that Wadada has committed other violent crimes is high. There's a high probability that he committed violence against women even before Sarah. He got away with it before, and he'll keep going until he's caught. When DNA evidence isn't submitted, it encourages perpetrators to keep committing crimes, and often these crimes escalate. Sarah was extremely lucky to have survived her ordeal. Rape does go underreported in the US many times, mostly because survivors of rape feel that they won't be believed. Sometimes, they feel that they are being put on trial before the police even find the suspect. A lot of times it's because the survivors don't want to face the accused in court because they're afraid. They don't want to relive that nightmare over and over again. They also don't want to be judged on their lifestyle or past experiences. Even when a survivor decides to press charges, rape is very hard to prove. Out of every 1,000 rapes committed in the US, 13 will be referred to a prosecutor, and only 7 cases will lead to felony convictions. Many perpetrators arrange for plea deals for shorter sentences, and sometimes the plea deal saves a survivor from having to show up at trial, so that they don't have to go through court proceedings. cross-examination by the defense can be particularly brutal. Defense attorneys will dig into every aspect of a survivor's life and will almost put them on trial. There have been several attempts by legislators to stop this practice, but at this point, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed in the judicial process to make this any easier on survivors. If a survivor chooses to not prosecute a perpetrator, the district attorney can choose to prosecute the case without the survivor being involved, but that rarely happens. DNA evidence was new at the time of Sarah's attack. The first time DNA was used to prove a case was in 1987, when serial rapist Tommy Lee Andrews was convicted of breaking into two women's homes and raping them at knife point in Florida. Andrews was sentenced to 32 years in prison. Upon his release from prison, he was involuntarily committed to the Florida Civil Commitment Center for 9 years. He was released back into society in July of 2021. His victims claimed that he should not have been released. He should have remained behind bars. The two attacks that he was convicted of should have added up to over 100 years in prison. DNA evidence linked Andrew to 20 more rapes in the Daytona area of Florida. The Andrews case opened up the discussion for law enforcement and district attorneys to consider DNA testing as a powerful tool in convicting or exonerating those accused of crime in the U.S. The FBI created the CODIS system and made it fully functional in 1998. CODIS stands for Combined DNA Index System. Any person convicted of a crime who has had DNA collected will have their DNA profile uploaded into CODIS for comparison to DNA collected at other crime scenes across the country. By 1999, 47 states were collecting DNA from those convicted of violent crimes. New Mexico didn't begin collecting DNA from offenders until 2013. Now, New Mexico does collect DNA from crime scenes, but under state law, they don't collect DNA from suspects without a warrant or probable cause. In 2020, New Mexico had 5,400 untested rape kits dating back to the 1980s. This was one of the highest numbers of untested backlog kits in the U.S. All of these kits were finally tested in 2021. And now, New Mexico has mandated that all rape kits be tested within 90 days. Sarah's rape kit may have been among the kits that sat on the shelf for 40 years. This would contribute to the fact that her case has gone unsolved for this long. I'm not sure that the DNA was even taken in Sarah's case. Sarah's was the first case in New Mexico to indict a suspect on a John Doe warrant. A John Doe warrant essentially stops the clock on the statute of limitations. When there is a suspect in a case that can't be identified by name, a John Doe warrant is issued. If there is a statute of limitations on the crime, this warrant will stop the statute of limitations from running out before they find the perpetrator. Normally, a John Doe warrant is issued in reference to DNA evidence left at the scene of a crime. The warrant in Sarah's case made no reference to DNA, only to the composite sketch done of Wadada and the deformity of his hand. In Sarah's case, there is no statute of limitations. First-degree criminal sexual penetration and first-degree attempted murder have no statute of limitations attached in New Mexico. The other charges against Wadada included aggravated battery with the intent to commit a violent crime and kidnapping. In 2018, Parabon Nanolabs began doing a process called DNA phenotyping. This process essentially creates a composite sketch of a perpetrator without having a DNA match. This technology can give traits such as eye color, skin color, freckling, and hair color using a person's genetic code. It can also reference race and nationality. The composites generated through DNA phenotyping are uncanny. Parabon also does genetic genealogy tracing beyond CODIS. They run genetic profiles against those who have voluntarily submitted their DNA to databases all around the world. Genetic genealogy can match DNA to family members going back 6 degrees. Then law enforcement can reference public records to find perpetrators through home sales, census, and tax documents. Several cold cases have been solved using this technology. Most infamously, this was how the Golden State Killer was found and arrested. Once again, Sarah Beard's case is still open. If you have any information about the attack on Sarah Beard or the location or identity of Wadada, please call Albuquerque Police at 505-242-COPS. Thanks for listening and stay safe, New Mexico. I want to shout out Jackie Moranti for researching and writing this episode. I'd also like to shout out Victoria Zeller for the initial research related to this case. And thank you to everyone who has supported this show over the last 3 years.
Thanks for listening to True Consequences. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at True Consequences Pod, and on Twitter at True Cons Pod. True Consequences is listener supported. If you'd like to support this one-man show, please go to patreon.com/trueconsequences. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico.